This meeting is being recorded.
So I'm Kathy Benner, and this is our meeting for tonight is our Ohio Writers Guild, and we are interviewing Elliot Parker, and we're going to talk to Elliot. But before we do that, I want to tell you just a little bit about myself, and then I'm going to go to Sandy. She is my co-host, my co-mod. And while I'm thinking about it, Sandy, I'm going to make you my co-host there. And for me, I was in the salon industry for 25 years, and once I retired, I was afraid that I was going to get bored, so I started an international academy, and one of the lanes in my international academy is a writing lane, because I even told my mom when I was probably, I don't know, maybe 12 years old, I said, well, someday when I retire, I'm going to be a writer. Like, I didn't even know what that meant exactly, but I was a ferocious reader, and I would go through stacks of library books, and, you know, and we lived out in the country. And so my favorite day of the week in the country was bookmobile week or bookmobile day, because I could go to the corner and I think we were allowed 10 books or something like that. Anyway, I would get as many as I was allowed to have. And then, of course, I didn't get anything done. I didn't get my chores done because I had my nose in a book all the time. So I was always accused of that as a kid, that you never get your chores done. And it's because I just love to read. But I was never bored because I would take all of these adventures through these books around the world. And so now in my retirement, I'm trying to fill those big shoes and take some of those adventures in real life. So we'll see how that works out. But anyway, we're off to Italy this coming Saturday. And so we kind of moved everything around. So if some of you get this replay and you're like, oh, I missed seeing Elliot in person, it's because we moved the date, because I'm going to be out of the country. So anyway, welcome. And I'm going to turn it now over to Sandy and let her tell you a little bit about what she does. She is my co-host, my co-mod for the Ohio Writers Guild, and she has some great information for you. Sandy.
Hi, thank you. Thank you very much, Kathy, and welcome, Elliot. High school English teacher for many, 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 many years. And about the last 10 that I was spending in the classroom, I was wanting to be more and more of a professional writer of my own, and thought, piece of cake, right? I've analyzed everything from Shakespeare to American writers to South American writers. This ought to be easy. But it was like staring at a blank canvas and trying to create something from scratch, going, how do you do this? And so that's when I started finding writing classes, and all back then, before webinars were a thing, going to writing conventions and learning how to put those words on the page to make it as fascinating to the reader that I was fascinated by as a reader. And that also is a trick for sure. Over the years, I've had short stories. That's where I started, because I realized it was going to take me forever to learn how to write a novel, or at least in my head. So I go, you know, I'll start with a short story. Then at least I'll get the idea of what a beginning, a middle, and an end is like in a storytelling. So I did, and got some short stories out there. And my life as teaching also journalism worked, as I was hired to do, you can see how far back I'm going, hired to do the biography of George W. Bush when he was first elected and inaugurated. And after that, I had done another one of a Spanish explorer of South America. And my love is fiction. And even today it is so. About 5 or 6 years ago, I had a friend who wanted to put a writer's workshop in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And there was one there for over 30 years called the Antioch Writers Workshop, and then it faded. So she wanted to jump on this. Well, after the first year, she realized she just wasn't cut out for this and offered it to me. And for some reason, I didn't say no. And it is like the classroom of my dreams. These are people who really want to be there. They're as anxious and interested in writing as I am. And it has been fun. And this coming year, I have, you'll know him, Elliot. He said he was just on your podcast when I was chatting with him. Andrew Welsh Huggins, mystery. I'm going with mystery writers this year. And I have the Ohio audiobook narrators. They're coming in with a team of three of them, and they're going to tell you as a writer how you can either do the audio yourself, what will be needed, or how they will do it for you. That there's another one or two I'm hoping to bring to the workshop as well. So it's building. But definitely, if you check out the website, it's up. Registration won't open until about Thanksgiving. But by all means, I'd love to have you on the Into the Springs newsletter so I could keep you up to date, or join Into the Springs Writers Workshop on Facebook. Love to have you there. Thanks, Kathy.
Oh, I love it. I went last year. It was so much fun. So if you're listening to this live or you're listening to the replay, check it out. It's called Into the Springs Writers Workshop. If you just Google that, you'll find it. You'll find the website. You'll find the Facebook page. Sandy put it in the chat. I will also include that in the description of this video when we're finished. So definitely check it out. It is it's lots of fun. And if you want to write, it's great to be in a room full of writers. I love that. Yeah, that's the best part. Is the people that we get to meet. So I'm going to switch now over to Elliot. And Elliot, we're going to reach kind of back into your past a little bit. Tell us a little bit about your journey on who you are, what it is that you do, and how you actually became motivated to write your very first book. Because we've got a lot of newbies in this group and they're wanting to write. They don't know where to start. It's kind of like Sandy decided to do short stories. I decided to do a collaborative effort with some other authors so that I didn't have that obligation of having to write the whole thing. And that way I could just write my section of it. And it just seemed a little more doable to me. So tell us your journey and what motivated you to say, I'm going to write a book.
Well, first of all, thank you, Kathy and Sandy, for having me. And I'm delighted to be here and to talk about writing. I can't think of anything more fun than to talk about writing and books and reading and writing processes and all of that sort of thing. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I started like most writers do, being a big reader. I know, Kathy, you talked about that a moment ago with yourself and being a voracious reader growing up. And I was very much the same way. My mom was the big reader in our family. And so we had books all over our house, you know, even in the bathroom. And my mom is one of these readers that she can have like four books going at the same time and she can keep everything straight and the characters and the plots and all that. I didn't inherit that, but I did inherit her love for reading. And so I was always seeing her reading. She read to me. My dad read to me. Both sets of my grandparents read to me. So, you know, this idea of books and words and storytelling was something that was, you know, sort of ingrained in me at a very young age. And it's the one thing that I felt like in school I was always good at. You know, I wasn't really a great math student. I wasn't really good at science. I was so-so in history. I was really good in English, but I really loved to read. And I found that all through school, both, you know, elementary school, junior high school, and even college, being a big reader served me well. And it certainly served me well in my professional life as well, being able to read and to critically think about what I've read and interpret and analyze what I've read has certainly helped me. But so I'd always grown up around books, and I had an eighth grade English teacher, Mr. Cyrus, when I was in junior high, and I won the junior high writing award, the eighth grade writing award, I think, that year.
Okay.
But I don't remember how or why that happened, but I just remember Mr. Cyrus saw something in me, and he would ask me from time to time, what am I writing? You know, are you writing anything? What are you working on? And I would say, well, no, not really. I'm this. And they said, well, you know, you need to get on that, you know, write. And he was this tall man. He was a Vietnam veteran, tall man with a white beard. He was like 6'6", real lanky, talked in a real deep voice. And he would say, now, you need to be writing, you need to be doing something with writing. And so he would always get on me about that. He would slip me little quotes, little inspirational quotes on slips of paper about writing, or about authors would say things about writing. And so he was the one that really, I think, saw something in me, or saw something in potential in me to do this. But it wasn't until I got into college and I had a friend, I went to Marshall University, and I had a friend who was trying to start a creative writing club on campus. And I was a journalism major. He was an English major. And so he roped me into being in this creative writing club because they were trying to get a charter by the university. And in order to get a charter, you had to meet so many times, and you had to have so many people show up to the meetings consistently. So he was like, look, I don't care if you write anything or not, if you're interested or not, I just need you to keep the chair warm till we get this charter. I was like, all right, fair enough. So long story short, I stayed in the club 2 years. The last year I was there, we all agreed to work on something and workshop something, and send it out for publication. And of course, this was in the days before submittable. You had to get the self-addressed stamped envelopes and the big manila folders and all that stuff. And so I'd worked on a short story, a little short, a ghost story, that had been sort of, you know, kicking around in my head a little bit. And, I was in a room with, you know, there were some poetry folks, there were some playwriting folks, there were some fiction, nonfiction writers. And so it was a nice mix of folks. And we workshopped this piece, all everybody's pieces all year. And in May we sent them out. And, there was a literary journal in Mary Washington College, which I think is Mary Washington University now in Virginia, called Spec, that published my short story. And that was the very first time I had anything creatively published. And that was the first time that I thought, oh, wow, you know, maybe I could do that. And maybe I have some talent in this. Maybe this is something I'd like to do. And I had so much fun writing that story. And so as time went on, I wrote more short stories, got more short stories published. And then back to your question about when did I decide to tackle a novel? I was working on my MFA at Eastern Kentucky University. And one of my professors, Derek Nikitas, I was talking to him about wanting to write a novel because I'd been writing short stories mostly in the program. And he basically said, well, if you think about it, a novel is just one big short story with a lot of small short stories in between. And I thought, I never had thought about it that way. And so working with him and the faculty there, I started putting together this idea for a novel. And it was it ended up getting published by Mid-Atlantic Highlands Press. It was called Breakdown at Clear River. And it's a murder mystery set on a fictional college campus in West Virginia, which is where I'm from. And that's really kind of how it got started. And you know, I had a lot of moments when I started that I didn't think I was going to finish. I thought, is anybody going to like this? Does this make any sense? It makes sense to me, but is it going to make sense to somebody who, you know, hasn't been to college for a long time, or doesn't remember what it was like, or has never been to college? And you have all those self-doubts and everything. But it was a wonderful, gratifying experience. And I believe that, you know, we did that book went through three or four printings. I think it sold almost 10,000 copies, which for a first novel and for a small press, yeah. I was just elated that it went well. And so that's how I got. So I got the writing bug really started with that short story in college. And then I got the novel writing bug sort of with the Breakdown at Clear River book. And I've just been doing it ever since. But I still love short stories. And I still find myself coming in between projects, or if I've written myself into a corner on a current project and I can't get myself out of it, or I can't get my characters out of it, I'll go back to a short story and tinker with that. So I love that short story form. And I feel like that if you're just trying to kind of get your hands around writing and around handling things like plot and character and dialogue and all of those sorts of things, short stories are great places to start, because there's an economy that has to be observed there with, you know, with language and with structure, because, you know, most short stories are 7,500 words or shorter. So you've really got to kind of grab the reader from the beginning, move them through, create these interesting characters, have good dialogue, but you got to move the story along. You got to keep things moving. You can't, you know, have, you know, 1,500 words of scene description or 1,500 words of exposition about something else. You really got to keep it moving. But it's a great form, and I'm so glad that we're seeing short stories commercially making a comeback. If you go to a bookstore, you'll see a lot of short stories on the shelves now, you know, on the bestseller lists and on the, you know, recently published lists, where, you know, 5, 6, 7, 10 years ago, almost nobody published short stories other than university presses. So the short story is making a comeback, and I'm really thrilled to see that. But I love novels too. And it was a lot of fun writing that first novel, and I enjoy that form as well.
Well, I noticed that on Amazon that they are actually promoting novellas, which again, you didn't see that early on. And so, yes, I do see some of that coming out on Amazon. And so that's kind of fun. But my next question is, how did you really know when you were ready? You're a little more immersed into the whole writing, I'll say, community than maybe what the average listener might be to this podcast. If they're working a job, they've got the kids, they're whatever, and they're thinking, I really want to write. It's hard to know when you're ready. Was there any aha moment for you that you just knew you were ready?
Well, two things really helped me. One was joining a writing group. And I strongly encourage that for everybody, no matter where you are in your writing journey. If you're just getting started, if you've never written or published anything, or you've just got an idea and you don't really know what to do with that idea that's sort of been percolating around in your mind, I think I'd like to write a story about this or maybe a book about that. Join a writing group and don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to walk in and say, look, I never published anything, haven't written anything, but I've got this idea. Don't be afraid. If there's not a writing group in your community, start one. And I would recommend to folks to go to your local public libraries and talk to the librarians there and say, hey, we would like to I'm going to start a writing group, because they can help you with the promotion and get the word out through their listservs in various places. Plus, most libraries will give you a room to use for the meetings for free. So you kind of get a little advantage that as well. So if you don't have one in your community, I would encourage you to start one. So that was a great help, because I was in a writing group for a long time called the Patchwork Writers. And we had probably, 8 to 11 people that came faithfully and consistently. And we had all kinds of different, writers there. We had some fiction writers with some nonfiction folks, some memoirists, some poetry people, nice mix of writers doing different genres in that group. And so those folks gave me some tremendous feedback and perspective on parts of my stories and books that I was working on, because I would take a chapter or two in. How we did it then, you would send it the week before our meeting, and then we would workshop the story. Everybody signed up for a month and you would have your stories workshop. And so I would take a couple chapters at a time into that group, and they would give me kind but constructive feedback. They would say, I really like this. This was really great, but you lost me here. Or, on page 3, you said this, but on page 1, your character said that, and that doesn't match. Things that I couldn't see necessarily, because I was writing the draft myself. So that was a huge help to help me. And then the second thing I did was, when I got something a little more polished, when I felt like I had a very first draft, or what James Patterson, I think, is called the dump draft, where you just kind of dumped everything down on the page and you don't know if it's going to work or not. And half of it's probably going to come out or have to be revised or taken out. Then I got some beta readers, and these were people outside of my writing group. These were writers I had met at book festivals, writers I had met through other means. And I always pick 3, and I still do this. I pick 3. I pick somebody in my genre. I pick somebody in another genre, and then I pick somebody who's a big reader, but not a writer. So that way you get 3 different perspectives. You get somebody who's writing in your genre that can look on, if I'm writing, I write mostly mysteries and thrillers. So I get somebody in my genre that can say, that chapter really lags, that red herring doesn't make sense. Or, you really got to pick up the pace here in chapter 5. It's really slowing down. And then I've got somebody that is a writer in a different genre that can say, I really would like a little more scene description here. Or you've got a fight scene that just loses me after the 3rd paragraph, and I need that either tightened up or cleaned up. And then I would have somebody, and this rotates around. I have like a cauldron of like 15 people that I ask from time to time to do this. Then I have a few people that are big readers, but not writers, who read all the time and read everything. And they're really good to pick up on things like pacing and tension, yeah, and moments where they got bored with the story or felt like they wanted to turn the page and skip a few pages to get to the next thing. That's the feedback I need to hear. That's the feedback I want to hear. And so those two ways really helped me get to the point where I feel like, okay, I think I've got a draft, and it's probably going to need another revision or two, depending on what it is and where we are. But, I start with the feedback from the writing group, and I start with the feedback from the beta readers, And then I do a big revision of that based on their feedback. And not everything they say I agree with. You know, sometimes they'll say, well, you know, I didn't like when the character said that to the other character. Well, I did. And so the dialogue stays, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. You can overrule your beta readers in your writing group. But 90% of what they say or 95% of what they say is it has been excellent feedback. And it's been things I couldn't see as I was writing the story. So those are the two places that, and after I get feedback from those two folks and I kind of do a revision, then I go back and read through it again. And I'm like, okay, I feel like this is, we're getting closer. We may need another revision or so, but I don't really take anything forward seriously until I get feedback from those two constituency groups. And once I get feedback and comments from them and make the revisions, and then sometimes I'll send that back to a couple of the beta readers or some people in my writing group and say, hey, read this all the way through and tell me what you think. So, you know, that changes depending on, you know, people's schedules and everything. But, you know, long story short, I wait to get feedback from them before I really feel comfortable that I've got something really that's ready to move forward.
Well, I want to ask you a couple of I'll call it logistical technical questions. When you're mapping out your story, do you have a particular software that you use, or are you the old fashioned with the pegboard on the wall and you're putting your characters up there and putting your plot lines up so that you know that your story is going to continually move forward and it's going to flow? Or do you have a software program, your favorite, that you like to use? How do you do that?
Well, I am old
fashioned. This is my struggle right now. So this is a real big question for me, because that's right where I'm at.
I understand. There's a book that came out several years ago. I don't know if you all remember this. It was one of these self-help books, but it was something to the effect of everything I learned about life I learned in kindergarten.
Yes.
I don't remember who the psychologist was that wrote that. I love that book. But one of the things he talked about in that book is that, you know, one of the things that we learn is how important like seeing things in front of us are and how important colors are. So I've carried that theme over with the way that I plan books. And I use one of those ginormous poster boards.
Okay.
And it's bolted to the wall in the next room, or I'd bring it into you and show it to you. But I'm on a first name basis with the post-it note folks at Office Depot, because I go in and buy the post-it note in huge bulk, you know. And when I go in to buy them, they're like, oh, you're working on another book, aren't you? I'm like, yep, I'm stocking up. But but on this post-it note board, I'll get like, you know, green post-it notes or character, pink post-it notes or plot. Blue post-it notes might be setting. And so I just kind of arrange the board in columns with little pieces of information, character names, plot elements, just different things. And I'm constantly moving that around. And I found that two things happen with that. And I know that seems very, very old fashioned, but I can see from writing session to writing session where I am, where I've come from and where I am. And I can see kind of where I left off. Instead of having to spend, you know, 30 minutes rereading the last 10 pages of what I wrote yesterday, I can walk in and I've got it on this board and I can say, oh yeah, yeah, I remember. Yes. Here is, and I'll number the post-it notes like 1 through 10. Oh yeah. You moved post-it note 4 down to column 2 over here. And so now that means you're closer to bringing that character into this particular plot point and all of that kind of thing. Okay. So I'm constantly moving those things around. And, that's also sort of, I also do that because psychologically on those days where you feel like you haven't had a good writing day, or, you know, you're tired, or you've got a lot on your mind, and you go in and say, well, you know, I was hoping to get 500 words today, but I only got 20. You know, I can look at that poster board and say, well, you know what? You didn't get a lot of writing done, but you got a lot of thinking and the cognitive part of your storytelling was accomplished. So you did make progress, maybe not at the keyboard, but you made progress on the wall. And so I have tried those software programs. I know there's a lot of different ones out there. But I get too bogged down in trying to figure out like where to put things and how to access them. Those software programs remind me, I'll tell you what they remind me of, Kathy and Sandy, they remind me of a ginormous Excel spreadsheet. And I love Excel, but if you don't know how to use Excel, it's maddeningly frustrating. And I feel like those software programs,
you spend your time trying to figure out the program.
It's exactly right. And next thing I know, I've spent 90 minutes or 2 hours trying to figure out, okay, where do I put the characters' traits you know, what platform in this software do I put the character's traits? And I could be spending that time writing. And so, and that's just me. I know I have some writer friends that can pick it up in 30 minutes. They've got it all figured out backwards and forwards and they know what to do. But I just, to me, it's those things are like big Excel sheets, and I can use Excel a little bit, but I'm not an expert. And so I'd rather spend that time writing and thinking and making progress. And so, and like I said, that poster board, that big post-it note board really works well for me. And I can chart my progress. I can see the threads that are emerging. You know, and for example, if I've got a character on a couple post-it notes and he or she's moving all over the board and I'm thinking, oh, well, you know, I was going to make that character a minor character, but suddenly this person's popping up in all these different scenes. So maybe we're not going to kill him off after all. We're going to let him hang around a little while.
Your characters do take on a life of their own, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Or I think, you know what, we won't throw him over the bridge. Maybe it'll chapter 8 instead of chapter 3. Things just slowly emerge, you know, as you're working. But I feel like even in those software programs, I lost my place. I couldn't remember where I'd left off, where I had put things. And I was going back into them. Scrivener, I think, is the last one I used.
Yeah.
And I was just going in there. I couldn't remember where I put this detail or that note. And I was spending an hour trying to figure where I'd put things. And I thought, this is silly. I'm just going to keep using what's worked for me, which is the old fashioned, like from kindergarten, the color and the visuals and all of that. Yeah. And that's worked really well for me. But I think you have to find what works well for you. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I have some writer friends that love Scrivener and swear by it and say that it's changed the way that they write and stay organized, but it just didn't work for me. But whatever method works well for you, you find it and use it. And, you know, there's no shame in doing it. You know, I think there's no shame in doing it one way as opposed to another.
Yeah.
One of the things that I did most recently is I ran across a program. I do a little bit of freelance writing on the side, and a friend of mine wanted me to do an article for his magazine, Connected Columbus. And so, I started writing. And so I went through, and submitted an article, maybe, and it's quarterly, seasonal. So I did articles in about four or five quarters of his magazine. And then he ended up was getting ready to publish his first book, and he got behind schedule. And I said, is there anything I can do to help you get across the finish line on this particular edition of your magazine? I said, I know you've just been totally over here working on your book. And he said, I use a program called Trello. I don't know if you've heard of it. And I said, what is Trello? And he said, I'll send you a link and I'll make you a user on my Trello. So I went into Trello, and all it is, it's an electronic board, exactly what you're talking about, but it's on your computer screen and you create these lists and then you put these cards on the list and you can just click and scoot the card onto any list you want anywhere. So you can, so I decided, like you, I'm very visual. So I decided in my Trello, when I started working on my book, I did all of my character development on each different card. I could put a picture of an image of what I wanted that character to look like. And then I started making a list for each chapter. And then again, like you, I can click and move those cards right across. And sometimes I'll have a story idea. So I have a card, a color card for my, because they're all color, different colors. So I had a card for my story idea, and I didn't get to it in the chapter that I thought I would get to that storyline. And so I could just click on it and scoot it over to the fall. And so I've got one card that I've scooted four chapters over now. It just keeps getting pushed out. To where now I'm starting to wonder, maybe I'm not even going to get to that storyline, and that maybe I need to put that in a saved storyline for another story, another book somewhere. But it sounds like I'm doing the exact same thing you're doing, but I'm doing it electronically, whereas you're doing it, you know, on an actual board. But
yes, it does. So for, it sounds very, yeah. Yeah.
So for the listeners, it's an option. If you don't want to get into all those writing programs and you just need a way to kind of plot out your story, Trello, it's a free program. So you can give that a look, or buy a board. Now, I also have a board on the wall. It's right here in front of me. And it's got post-it notes on it. And it's how I keep track of all, I do rental properties as my main income. And that's how I keep track of all my tenants and all of that good stuff. So yeah, I get it. You got to have it in front of you. So how did you make time? Oh, how do you spell Trello? Oh, Chanel, you spelled it exactly right. Trello. Yep. Elliot, how do you make time I know you're busy. How do you make time in your schedule for writing? When you're in the middle of a novel, do you give yourself a deadline? And then try to figure out, okay, I've got to write so many words a week, or I got to write so many hours a week. How do you get that into your schedule? I know folks that have been writing a book for 10 years.
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I guess I have worked in careers in my professional life that have always been set with deadlines. And so I have to give myself a deadline, an artificial deadline, to get things done, or else everything else will pop up that will take away your time to finish whatever it is that you're working on, the story or the novel. And basically how I do it is I basically schedule it. I just work it into my schedule. You know, you can do it different ways, daily, weekly. This semester, I teach at Ole Miss. And so this semester has been really, really busy. I've got a couple of projects and a couple of grant projects I'm working on. So my writing length of time has not been as long as it has been in the past. But I have to schedule that. I have to just go into my calendar, go into my Outlook calendar, and block off time to write. And I'm pretty fiercely protective of that writing time. I mean, I try to set it up in a way and in a manner and such that I don't have anything going on, or that I'll be able to sit down for 2 hours or 90 minutes or however I block off that time to work on it. And again, some days I get 500 words if things are really going well. Other days, if I'm tired and I've had a busy week or a stressful week or haven't slept well all week or whatever, I may not get as much words done in terms of words on the page, but that's the only way for me I make progress on projects. I mean, if I wait for quote unquote the muse to strike, or if I wait for, you know, the inspiration sort of hit me like in the back of the head, like a lightning bolt, you know, there'll be something that'll distract me. You know, there's there's papers to grade, there's meetings to do, there's class prep, there's laundry, there's grass to cut, there's, you know, all these other things that we do as adults, there's grocery store runs and this and that, all these things that we have to do. You know, we all wear so many multiple hats in our lives, and you just have to kind of find a writing hat, figuratively speaking, or make yourself a writing hat and make that a part of the rest of your schedule. And, you know, I'm fiercely protective of that writing time. If I've got it blocked off, then that's what we're doing. We're writing. And if that means I miss going to the movies with friends, or I miss, you know, the second half of the Super Bowl or whatever's going on, you know, then that means I miss it, because if I don't make any progress on anything. And so I kind of start with a large deadline. Okay, I want my dump draft finished by Easter weekend, let's say, if I was starting now. I want it done by Easter weekend. And so kind of work back from that deadline and say, okay, now based on, you know, what my work schedule is going to be next semester, and based on all these other things I've got, all these other commitments to my time, where am I going to be able to block off time? Is it going to be Monday, Wednesday, Friday? Is it going to be Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday? Is it going to be, you know, how's it going to be? Is it going to be morning, afternoon? I'm not really a night owl. My brain kind of shuts down as the evening progresses. So usually I will schedule my writing time, you know, in the mornings or in the early afternoons. So I kind of work back from that artificial deadline and just block off time. And during that time, you know, I put my cell phone in the other room. I turn my email off. I log on my email. I just kind of make myself, you know, go off the grid, as they say, and just totally sit down and write, because otherwise you'll have that pulling on your time too. There's always an email to check, or a text message to respond to, or this, that, or the other that you've got to take care of. And so that's how I do it, because I found that if I don't, then, you know, a project that might take me 6 to 9 months is going to take me, like you were saying, you know, 5 years or 10 years, because, you know, it's really difficult. And I know you can do it, but it's really difficult to make, I think, significant progress if you're just writing 10 minutes a day, you know, three times a month. And I just don't know. I don't know how you're developing continuity with your story if you're only looking at it three times a month for 10 minutes here and there. Now, I know for some people, maybe that's all that they have, and I understand that. But, you know, if you're really trying to get something, you know, at least a completed draft of something, you have to give more time to it than that, or else you're never going to make any progress. And or your story's going to have a lot of holes and a lot of gaps, because, you know, you might have looked at it on October the 15th and haven't seen it again since November 25th. Well, you know, lots happened since then, you know, with your mind and your thinking and all of that. So that's kind of how I do it. And I just feel like scheduling that time and just moving, making that time and moving it into your calendar, like you do everything else that you have going on in your life, make sure that you can, that you have that time to write and just kind of go off the grid, you know, turn your devices off, log out of your email. I've even made announcements to friends. I've said, look, don't text me or call me between 10 and noon on Friday or whatever, because I'm not answering, I'm writing. And for a while, I think some friends thought I was joking because they would text me or say, hey, you want to go do this? And I wouldn't respond. And then after that happened a couple times, they were like, yeah, he's pretty serious. And he says he's going to write. So that's what works for me. And I feel like, and I feel like I'm making progress that way. And then I'm able to, you know, transition out of one project onto the next project, you know, even if that dump draft is going to sit in the drawer, sit on the computer in the cloud for a while, before I get back to it, I can start working on the next thing. And so I'm not constantly, you know, putting off other ideas or other things I want to write because I'm just kind of nibbling on the edges with this current project.
I love that. I have a girlfriend who actually has a writer's closet. She had a closet that wasn't very wide, but it was kind of deep. And she took everything out and she put a writer's desk in the back, facing the back wall, and it's just big enough for the writer's desk and her chair, and she can go in and shut the door behind her, and she literally is in the closet. And she has since then started a podcast, and she does her podcast from, that's where her computer is, so she does a podcast from there. She said the acoustics are pretty good because she's in the closet, and then she does her writing, that's her writing closet, and she said that her family knows that when she goes in and shuts that door, they are to leave her alone. So I love that. I love that. So anyway, have you ever, and I think this is probably something that every writer goes through. Have you ever written a book and now, you know, you've, it's for us females that have had children, we think of it like we're birthing a baby, you know, cause we're happy with it when it's well, and we're up with it all night when it isn't. And when you finally launch that book and it gets published, do you ever think, oh, I should have done this in that chapter, I should have written that? Do you ever have any of those moments that you wish you could go back and fix something after it's published?
You know, when Breakdown at Clear River came out, I made the mistake of sitting down and reading it through. And I had a lot of those moments. It came out in 2010, I believe, 2012 is when that book came out. And I made the mistake against what other writers had told me, you know, don't sit down and read your work from cover to cover. And I had terrible moments, Kathy, of that, where I was thinking, oh my gosh, why I should have added that detail, or I forgot to mention that, or, you know, that, you know, they should have had this conversation. Why didn't I have the father respond to Cullen this way instead of that, and all this stuff, all this angst and kind of, you know, coulda, woulda, shoulda kind of things. And so now what I do is I just don't.
Okay.
I don't go back and read them again because, well, there's a couple reasons for that. One, logistically speaking, by the time that book comes out, from the time you turn the final manuscript in, is anywhere from 9 to 12 to sometimes 14 to 16 months. I'd say 9 to 16 months, depending on the press and, mm-hmm. and who you're working with and their publishing schedule and when they're going to release the book and timeliness and all of that. So in many ways, I not that I've forgotten everything, but I, you know, the little nuanced things I've forgotten, you know, I've forgotten about that by now. And usually I'm onto another project, or I've started another project, or I'm a third of the way into another book. And so, I mean, I love those characters and I still, you know, appreciate them and all of that, but I'm onto another set of characters, another story. And so logistically speaking, I kind of forget some of those finite details. So that's the first thing. But secondly, what I've learned is if you go back and read it all the way through, I mean, there's always things that you could improve and would want to fix and want to change. And, you know, at some point, I think as writers, and a lot of writers have given me this advice in a variety of different contexts. And so I'm just kind of paraphrasing here, but a lot of them have said, you know, at some point, done is done. At some point, yeah. You have to say, OK, you know what? It's over. This book is the end means the end. And you want it to be certainly as strong as it can be. You want it to be the representation of your best thinking and writing. But at some point you have to say, you know what, I've got to let this go. And what it is what it's going to be. Otherwise you will worry yourself and always go back and tinker this and tweak that. And sometimes when you tinker and tweak something in chapter two, then you've got to go all through the entire yes. book and tinker and tweak something. And the next thing you know, now you're really behind on your timeline or whatever deadline you've either given yourself or that your publisher's given you or your agent's given you to get this done. And so those are the two reasons why I just kind of at some point I just say, you know, and I know now, I feel like that I've written enough now. Early in my career, I didn't really know. I didn't have that little voice telling me, yeah, you're done. It's time to move on. But the more I've written and the more I've had things published, I feel like that little voice is stronger now. And usually it's pretty right when it says, yeah, you know, you're finished with this. You know, you're finished with the, you've done the revisions, you've done the rewrites, you've made it as good as it can. Now it's time to let it go. Send it off into the world and see what happens. And I feel like if, as writers, if we're afraid to take that step, and it is so much like you were saying, Kathy, it is your baby. And, you know, you've reared this thing from just idea conception into this 85,000 word kind of living thing that you've been living with for who knows how long, depending on how long it's taken you to write it. But if you can't make that next step and say, okay, I'm letting it go, you know, I'm going to let it go. And it's as good as it's going to be, then you're never going to see it kind of in its next phase or in its next life. And if you sit down and read it all the way through, you're just going to kind of worry yourself and be harder on yourself, I think, than you want to be, because, you know that, you know, you might want to add that extra conversation in between two characters that you forgot to add, but, you know, in most cases, the reader's not going to notice the difference. You know it because you've been dealing with it, but it's not going to be something that they're going to say, oh gosh, you know, I wish that book stunk because those two characters didn't have this conversation or they didn't talk longer in chapter two. You know, most readers aren't going to say that. So you can't let the fear of somebody saying that or the fear of that criticism keep you from kind of letting it go. And so those are the two reasons why I've learned to just kind of, at some point you just have to say done is done. And this is the best it can be. This is the best I've done. This is the best I can do. And we're going to send it off and see what happens.
Yeah. Your best is your best. Yeah. Your best is your best. So there was a time that you weren't writing and now there's a time that you are writing and you're published and you have several books under your belt. Do you ever go back to one of those very early books and say, damn, that was good? And you're kind of proud of yourself. You're like, I did that. I actually did that. Because you do kind of forget those storylines and you go back and you realize just how good some of that stuff really is. I've written some courses before and then, you know, I moved on and moved on to other courses, other things. And then I'd run across some of that writing that I did, maybe 5 years ago. And I'm thinking, that's really good. I wonder I moved away from that, you know, that's really right on. Do you ever feel that way about some of your writing sometimes?
Sometimes I do, you know, where I kind of have that moment and that feeling, honestly, is when, you know, a reader will email you or will, you know, see you at a book event and maybe they've read another one of your books and they'll say, gosh, you know what, my favorite scene in your first book was that. Or, you know, I love that moment in chapter 12 where so-and-so said this to so-and-so and his response was this. And sometimes I'm like, ooh, did I write that? I don't really remember. That was, you know, like 5 years ago. I don't really remember. Did I write that? You know, anyway. But usually those kind of benchmarks are where I kind of think, well, yeah, you know, maybe that was pretty good. If you kind of get consistent feedback. Or if somebody says, you know, you'll get a lot of comments, you know, well, I really loved that character. I just loved, even mm-hmm. though he was a villain and even though he was just so awful in so many ways, I couldn't stop reading when he was on the page. You know, when you get that kind of feedback consistently or something similar to that, that's when I kind of say, oh, you know, I think I did that okay. You know, that he turned out all right, especially if he was a villain where I was having a tough time kind of getting my arms around him. Like, what does he believe? What do I want him to do? Because, you know, I think a really good villain in a mystery thriller story is not completely evil. You know, that there is a kernel of goodness somewhere in them, or you have a moment as a reader where you say, you know, I totally do not condone what he or she is doing, but I kind of understand why they're doing what they're doing. And I have a workshop on this called Writing Bad Guys That Readers Love to Hate. And we talk about this. We talk about this,
okay,
giving your villain a little kernel of not goodness, but a moment where the reader can say, you know what, I don't agree with how they've handled that. But I understand why they're behaving the way that they are. Now, it doesn't mean I'm rooting for them. It doesn't mean I want the protagonist of the story to lose, but I understand why this villain or this villainess is responding the way that they are. So those are just some things, you know, when you hear that kind of feedback from readers and it's consistent about certain things, that's when I'm kind of like, oh, I must have done okay. Even though I still think, oh gosh, I don't remember how I did that, but thank you for telling me. I don't tell them that, but I'm thinking in the back of my mind, oh, well, like I said, past 5 years ago, I don't really remember. Was she wearing a red dress? I don't remember, you know, I don't remember, but no, it's very nice to hear that. And I think as writers, I think, you know, Kathy and Sandy, we're our harshest critics and we are never, to some degree, ever satisfied with whatever we do and whatever we write. We always feel like it could be better or different or should have done this or could have done that. But, you know, when you hear that external feedback from a reader, especially if it's a reader that you don't know, if it's just sort of a random person that you have this conversation with, or somebody that comes up to you at a bookstore or something and says something to you, that's, you know, that's really gratifying and really fulfilling. One, that they read the story, but two, that there's something about your story they remember. And especially if they're a big reader and, you know, they've read all these other things since reading your book, but they still, when somebody mentions your name or the title of that story, they still remember something about it. That's really, really gratifying.
How did you choose your genre? How did you say, this is what I want to write about?
Well,
where you like to read all the time? And so it was just an automatic where you gravitated toward that for your writing. Did you make an actual decision? I mean, I made an actual decision. I do a lot of technical writing. But then when I wanted to write fiction, I made it. I decided, you know, what genre I wanted to be in. And now this is my first fiction book that I'm working on now. I can see my characters taking me somewhere else. And at the end going, oh, it doesn't really fit there like I thought it would. So I'm not sure where I'm going to end up. But did you make a decision where you wanted your books to end up?
A little bit. I got interested in mysteries and thrillers, you know, when I was a little kid. There were two sets of books that I loved growing up reading. One was the Encyclopedia Brown mystery series, which, okay, I don't know if you all are familiar with that. But the writer who wrote that just died just a few years ago. And anyway, Encyclopedia Brown was kind of this sort of savant, kind of semi-genius neighborhood kid. And he would solve all the mysteries in the neighborhood. And he charged you 25 cents. You put a quarter in the coffee can and he would solve whatever mystery that you had. And usually it was something like, you know, my cat's gone missing, or there's a broken window in our kitchen and mom thinks I did it, but I didn't hit the baseball that knocked it through. And so Encyclopedia Brown goes around and he, you know, tries to figure it out. And why they call him Encyclopedia Brown's because he doesn't forget anything. He's like an encyclopedia. You tell him something once and he's got like this great recall, you know, or he can remember the color of something that most people would sort of ignore. So I loved those books. I think there was, you know, 14 or 15 books in the series, and I read all of those. And then I also enjoyed those Scholastic Choose Your Mystery books that I understand or have come back in style, or have come back now. Scholastic is publishing some new ones. I guess that's the, you know, everything that is once old comes new again, I guess. But, you know, you basically would read this book and it would say, you know, if you want Jane to go down the dark path, turn to page 16. If you want Jane to get in the car with her friends and drive away, turn to page 26. And so you basically got two stories in one, because you wanted to read all the way through and make one set of choices and see what happens. And then you go back and read all the way through and make the opposite choices and see what happens. And so you ended up getting like two totally different stories, two different plots in one book with the same characters. And I loved all of those. I mean, I read probably, oh, I don't know, dozens and dozens of those. So those were my two favorite book series that I can remember growing up. And that really got me interested in that. And so I read a lot of, you know, I just kept reading more and more mysteries and thrillers as I got older. I will say one thing that I've really gotten into probably within the last 10 years, is I've really gotten into reading history.
Okay.
And I've loved history, but I'm really, really getting into reading about you know, world leaders. And, you know, I just finished a book called Burning Washington about the War of 1812. And why was the United States and President Madison so unprepared? They knew the British were coming and they saw them marching on Washington and we didn't do anything about it. You know, things like that. I read a book. I just finished a book over the weekend. I can't remember the lady's name that wrote it, but it was about Lee's army's Robert E. Lee during the Civil War after Appomattox, after they signed the surrender agreement with General Grant. Well, Lee had one more mission that he had to accomplish before he could dissolve the army. And so it's a story about Lee's army's final battle or final march after Appomattox, which is fascinating. It just stuff I'd never learned in history class, never knew before. But the point of me saying that is getting into reading history has made me a much better mystery thriller writer. Because you learn... you learn so much. I learned so much more in reading history about interpersonal relationships, you know, what draws people together, what draws, what draws Robert E. Lee together with, one of his subordinate generals, what draws in, you know, what made James Madison so timid? What were some of his personality traits that made him so timid and so afraid to challenge the British during the War of 1812? All of those things. So you learn a lot about that that you can work into your fictional characters. And you also learn a lot about dialogue and conversation. And, you know, one of the things I've learned about reading a lot of history over the last 10 or 15 years is that when you have these pivotal moments of history, somebody's not telling the truth for whatever reason. And somebody else has to figure out what the truth actually is and then act on that information. And that very much applies to mysteries and thrillers, because in a mystery thriller story, nobody's telling the truth. Nobody is telling the truth in a mystery or thriller story. And it's up to your protagonist to figure out, okay, who is telling somewhat of the truth, or who is giving me part of the truth, who's giving me none of the truth. And they have to sift through all of this to kind of ultimately figure out who's responsible and try to bring justice or punishment to the person who's guilty. And so there's just so many overlaps. And I never really realized that until I got into history. So I still read a lot of mysteries and thrillers, but boy, I've really, really enjoyed, I'd say probably since graduate school ended, I really have gotten into reading history. And I love history. And I read, you know, all kinds of history. I read this summer, I read Stacy Schiff's book about Samuel Adams, which was a finalist, I think, for the Kirkus Prize in nonfiction, which was wonderful. I read her book about Cleopatra and the relationship she had with Caesar. And you think, well, what's that have to do with mystery and thriller writing? But all of those internal conflict and conversations and manipulations and betrayal and all those things that we do in moments of tension, you can then kind of apply and massage and put into your own stories as well. So that's been a big help to me. I've really enjoyed the history and the nonfiction writing or reading. And I think it's helped my mystery and thriller writing. But yeah, it was Encyclopedia Brown and the Scholastic Choose Your Mysteries that really got me started.
I love it. I love it. Now tell us about your books. Start from how many books do you have, first of all? Right now, okay,
I've got five books in the collection of short stories. My first novel was Breakdown at Clear River. And then I have two books in a series that are set in West Virginia, where I was born and raised. One is called Fragile Brilliance, and the other one is called A Final Call. Both of those are set in Charleston, West Virginia, where I grew up. And there is a homicide detective named Ronan McCullough, who's in both of those stories. And then I have another mystery series, two books in that series, one called Code for Murder and the other called A Final Call, which came out, I guess, 2 years ago now. And that book features a female homicide detective named Stacy Tabbitt, and it's set in Cleveland, Ohio. So if you're familiar with Cleveland, or if you've been to Cleveland at all, my dad's family lived and worked up there. They were coal miners, and then when the mines shut down in the late 60s and early 70s, they all went north and worked, you know, in the steel mills and the shipyards and at the Goodyear rubber plant in Akron and all that. So we'd go up there and visit them all the time. So I was real familiar with that area. And I wanted to set a story someplace, not that was outside of West Virginia and sort of Ohio-ish, or said it in Ohio, but not like my part of Ohio, Southern Ohio, a different area of Ohio. So I said it in Cleveland. And so that book came out, I guess, 2 years ago now. In between those two series of those mystery series, those thriller series books, I have a short story collection called Snapshots. And there's 10 stories in that collection. It's a multi-genre collection of stories. So there's some speculative fiction. There's a family drama. There's a romance. There's a thriller. There's all kinds of different genres represented there. And then I have a new short story collection coming out next fall of 2024, called Table for Two. And the primary driver of that, that's a multi-genre set of stories as well. But everything that happens in those stories takes place between one-on-one conversations between two characters. So all of the tension, all of the conflict is primarily conducted in a one-on-one conversation. And sometimes it's between a mother and her disgruntled son. Sometimes it's between two jilted lovers. Sometimes it's between a cop and a bad guy. But the thrust of each story takes place in these one-on-one conversations. And so that was a tremendous challenge to write that. And I really feel like I grew as a writer, because it was a really strong exercise for me in terms of dialogue and tension. How do you keep the tension going when the primary conflict is a conversation that only two characters are having? And there's other characters that kind of weave themselves in and out, but the real tension of each story is in this long, elongated conversation that two characters have. So it was a great challenge to write that, but gosh, it was so much fun. I had so much fun writing them. And so I'm real, real excited for those to come out next fall and to share those with everybody. And really where some of the idea for that came from was after we got through this terrible period of COVID, and I hate to talk about COVID because I feel like it's Freddy Krueger. If we keep mentioning its name, it'll come back. You know, if you keep mentioning Freddy Krueger, he's going to come back. I keep saying Jason Voorhees, he's going to rise out of Crystal Lake and come after us. So I hate to mention COVID, but after COVID, I can remember when life was getting back to normal, I was listening to people and talking to people, and they said the thing they missed most during COVID was having one-on-one conversations with friends, with family, having coffee with coworkers, lunch with their parents, you know, drinks at 5 o'clock at happy hour with colleagues, and all these different things, these one-on-one conversations. And I got to thinking, well, you know, what if you did a short story collection where the thrust of every story was these conversations, these one-on-one conversations that people need to have and sometimes don't want to have? What would happen with those? And so that's where the idea for the story collection came from. But it was so much fun to write, but a real challenge too. So I'm real excited for those to come out next fall.
And I love the name, Table for Two. I love that. Yes. So much fun. I love everything that you're doing. I follow you, as you know, with what you're publishing and what you're writing and even what you're wearing for Halloween. So I pay attention to what's going on.
I was Wolverine this Halloween.
So I love it. I love it. I want to turn it over to Sandy. Sandy, did you have any comments or questions for Elliot before we find out how our listeners can connect with him and learn how they can get a hold of some of his books, since he just exactly what he's doing?
Well, you brought it up, Elliot. I was going to focus on your short story collection. How do you do it? Do you just look through your file folders going, yeah, time to take that one and stick it in a book, time to take that one? But I will be purchasing your Table for Two, because I thought, man, that's master thinking. Like, why not give you a writing exercise, so to speak, and such a discipline, and the amazing things of what comes out of it that you do. What do you do now when you're in a group of other writers at a professional gathering? What are you thinking about? Are you honing your own skills, or do you see yourself more helping others that they're kind of needing mentoring? What is it like for you at writing, if you know what I'm talking about, at writing workshops, writing conventions, as a published writer, rather than that hopeful writer that's going to be?
That's a fantastic question, Sandy. And thank you for asking that. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that. I will say that in those environments and in those situations, I try to be a good listener. and just listen to what other people have to say. Prior to that, what usually happens, and this usually is very true if there's food and beverages involved, particularly alcoholic beverages involved, is as we have a few of those and everybody kind of gets loose and relaxed, well, we talk about a lot of our challenges that we're having as writers, not necessarily with a specific project,
sure.
You know, like, oh, I can't get this character to be this in my story. But, you know, a lot of times we'll say, I'm really, really struggling with my time management, or I'm finding that, you know, my writing time is being cut into because I've got all these things going on. You know, I have a parent who's sick, or my child's really struggling in school, or, you know, I've got, you know, these issues going, health issues, or, you know, financial issues or whatever. So early on, especially if it's a group of people I know, you know, or have a history with, there's a lot of that. And that's helpful. And it's not really, I don't want to make it sound like it's a gripe session or a gossip session, because that's not what it is. But it's helpful just to know that there are people out there, some of whom are much more commercially successful than me, that are going through the very same issues and the same problems that I'm having. So there's a sort of a catharsis in knowing that you're not alone dealing with some of those issues. So that's the first thing that typically happens in a group like that, especially if it's a large group of people and I know or have a relationship, prior relationship with a lot of them. But, you know, if it's a more of a mixed group, or a group where there is maybe some novice folks, or folks who don't have a lot of publishing, I just try to listen and just, you know, listen to what folks have to say. You know, sometimes people just want to say, you know, I really got this great idea, and this is kind of what I'm thinking, and what do you think? Is that interesting? And I'll say, yeah, I really love that. And, you know, I'll say something like, to my knowledge, I don't know of a story that's written right now that's got that in it. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes somebody will say, you know, I'm really looking for a really good, you know, science fiction story centering on this. Do you know of any? And I'll say, well, yeah, I'm a big fan of this. Yeah. Sometimes I've listened and people have talked about, you know, publishing stories or publishing situations that didn't go well. Mm-hmm. It could be, you know, they had a story accepted for publication that somehow got removed out of the queue for whatever reason, or, you know, they had a book published and thought it was going to do this and it hasn't gone anywhere, or they're struggling with marketing, or, you know, there's just a variety of different things that come up. And so I feel like my role in those situations is to be a listener, and to help and to offer advice. You know, I try not to offer advice, but, you know, direct people in a way to maybe a writer or a book, or even a writer's handbook that might be helpful to them. Mm-hmm. And not just say, oh, well, I would do it this way, because, you know, everybody does things differently, but kind of point folks in a different direction. And I've adopted that mindset because so many people did that for me when I was starting out. And sometimes I just needed somebody to give me 10 minutes to just listen to me say whatever I had to say about my writing or my writing project. And I'm so grateful for that, because these were people that probably had better things to do than to listen to me squabble about whatever I was talking about. And yet they were so kind and generous with their time. And so, I try to take on that role in those environments and just listen and offer feedback and comments when needed. But I found that, you know, even if I don't offer any comments, just for someone to, another writer to have a writer listen to them, you know, eat for whatever reason and for a short amount of time, it makes such a big difference. And I'll have people say, thank you for listening. I know you didn't really say much, but thank you for taking the 10 minutes to listen to me talk. You know, and to me, that's where connections and relationships form, because no matter what happens, me and that person, we now have a bond, because I now know kind of what they're thinking or how, what they're writing or what they're reading. And so we always share that common thread. So for me, it's a way of building relationships and networking, but I'm thankful that people listen to me. And so I feel like, you know, I can pay it forward by doing the same for them.
I love that. I love that. Chanel says, love that. Yes, I love that too. A lot of times it's our family and friends are not as supportive as we would like. And so having somebody that is supportive is huge for especially a brand new writer that is feeling, you know, a little bit less than to begin with, like, oh, I don't know if I can even do this. And it's so great to have some other folks out there that are in their corner. So Thank you for that, Elliot. That's wonderful. How can our folks connect with you?
The easiest way to do it, I have a website. It's ElliotParker.com, ElliotParker.com. I've got information on there about, all the books that I've previously published are there. Information about Table for Two, as we get a little closer, we're going to have a cover reveal probably in January or February, right after the holidays. So information like that will go up on the website. You can see what the cover is going to look like. And so we'll have updates there, but you can find out information about my other books. You can also, there's a contact form if you want to reach out with a question or comment, or if you'd ever like to chat or have a Zoom chat or whatever, you can just email me on that contact form. It goes right to my email. If you don't want to do that, I'm on all the social media platforms. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and X or Twitter, whatever it's called now. I'm mostly on Facebook and Instagram. I'm of that group that kind of learned how to use those two platforms first. So I feel really, really comfortable in being able to use those. But I am on X or Twitter, too, as well. Just search my name, Elliot Parker, and you'll find me. So I'm pretty active there. So you can find me there, and I'm happy to answer any questions or talk about writing or give any direction I can, or if you just need somebody to listen to you for 10 or 15 minutes, I can do that too. So feel free to reach out. Happy to help anytime.
Good. I love that. Thank you so much for being with us. And thank you for all of our listeners. Chanel, thank you for being on tonight as our guest in the audience there, listening and commenting in the chat. And of course, this replay is going to go up on all of our different channels. And so folks will get to hear everything that we've talked about tonight. So to connect with me, you're going to go to KathyBenner.com. To connect with Sandy, to IntoTheSpringsWorkshop.com, and to connect with Elliot, you're going to go to ElliotParker.com. And all of that will be in the description of this video when we upload it. You'll find us on Vimeo, you'll find us on YouTube, and you'll find us on Audioboom. And so watch for us in the future as we interview a different author each month. And if you go to KathyBenner.com and scroll down to the calendar of events, you'll be able to see every time that we're going to be on, because it'll be on the calendar. And you can follow us on the calendar there and make sure that you don't miss an episode of the podcast. So again, I want to say thanks to Elliot. You were on with us last year. I loved you then. I love you now. So thank you so much for being on. And Sandy, as always, thank you for being my co-host, my co-mod. Can't wait for the Writer's Workshop again. And so anyway, is there any last comments or any anything anybody wants to say before we go today?
Good luck.
Thank you for the opportunity. It's been great. I appreciate it. Thanks, Kathy and Sandy, for all the work you do to promote Ohio authors and to keep the conversation going, because it's really important. And I'm honored to be on, and thanks for having me back.
Good.
Thank you so much. So with that, we're going to go for this evening. And so mark your calendars. Go to KathyBenner.com, scroll down to the calendar, and take a look at the calendar dates so that you don't miss a session. And Chanel, again, thank you. And we will see everyone next time.
Yep. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.